throughout your evening. But now, keeping you entertained and buzzed, I'm sure, is one of my personal heroes, a man you will know. He is going to be at the World Cup. It is the chief football commentator for ITV, Clive Tildesley. Clive, happy new year and welcome to Verve Sports.
To say Lionel Messi, then you're doing that, don't you?
Yeah, it's, tell you what, we try.
Disappointed right now.
I know. Oh, goodness me! But nevertheless, we get there in the end, Clive. Good to speak to you, sir. How you doing?
Yeah, really good. Nearly as good as Watford today.
I tell you what, we've had a man there today. 3-0. I was a little worried about this fixture, you know, of the Birmingham City, you know, beating Man U in the Carabao Cup, firing on all cylinders, but Watford get it done. Great result.
Yeah, it's maybe a sign of the times. I believe it was Bristol City who rested quite a few regulars. Obviously, they've got a major occasion coming in the next few days, you know, they've got other fish to fry. But, you know, that's the nature of the modern FA Cup. We're seeing teams as low as League One resting players for FA Cup ties.
Clive, it's a debate we've been having all show. The FA Cup, for me, still has that magic over and beyond its association with across the continent. But Dyche today, you know, his Burnley side thrashed by Man City, you know, said, look, the bottom line is we're a business to stay in the Premier League. Talk to me briefly about, the changes in that particular relationship that maybe you've seen throughout a very halcyon commentary career.
Well, I don't have to walk outside the front door. My son's 22 years of age and he's got a very different opinion of FA Cup football to me. I'm from a generation where the FA Cup final was for many years the only major club game that was televised live. There was a sense of occasion. The nation came to a standstill for 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon.
Yep.
In May. The television build-up began in the morning. There is, I think, a strong argument for saying that winning the FA Cup was more prestigious than winning the championship at the time. I think certainly those of us of a certain vintage would be able to name far more FA Cup winning teams from, say, the 70s and 80s than we would be able to name championship winning squads. But that's no longer the football culture of today, and the FA Cup has had to find its place in the new football, in the post-Premier League, post-Champions League football, and it's still doing that. And I don't think the dilution of its importance has finished. I wouldn't be surprised if in 5 years' time there are no FA Cup replays at all. What I think has happened, though, is that the FA Cup's found an unlikely bedfellow in terrestrial television. You know, obviously, I work for ITV. We had the FA Cup for quite a few years. The BBC have now got the lion's share of the television coverage. And neither the ITV nor BBC can compete with the Sky and BT millions to broadcast Champions League and Premier League football live anymore. It's just not possible. And so, you know, the FA Cup has kind of had the begging bowl out, and BBC could only spend so much money. And what do we get? We get a situation where last night 7 million people watched Everton play Liverpool in a football match on TV. The record ever TV audience for a match on Sky or BT is about 2.2 million. Now, this is a local derby, which you would think that perhaps there was limited interest outside of Merseyside. And I tell you, I don't know if your listeners are aware of what regular television figures are. The only programmes which got 7 million viewers last night were Coronation Street, Emmerdale and the FA Cup. That's where it's at.
It shows the appetite, doesn't it? And I think that's
absolutely
a brilliant point. But one thing I want to just bring to the table on that particular one is that I think that it shows, again, the narrative of the FA Cup, which almost brings into this kind of twin fusion with the post-kind of Premiership epoch we're in, which is the Van Dijk scenario. Here you have, you know, the most expensive defender of all time, £75 million, and that just shows you the business world we're in. heading, you know, what is the winning goal in front of his adoring fans for the first time, and that is the magic of the cup fusing with a player that many people would say, you know, I can remember when £1 million for a player was ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, I think the economics of football are they're difficult to justify, but actually quite easy to understand.
Yeah,
I mean, if you try to put into context spending, and it would appear now that Philippe Coutinho is heading for Barcelona as we speak for £142 million. So, you know, Liverpool have spent half of that amount of money on something they really needed, which
yes.
was a good defender. And they've lost a player who is arguably their best player, but of a type that they have probably three or four of a very, very excellent standard. So in that sense, they've probably done some pretty good business on the evidence of what we've seen in the last 24 hours. If you try to justify, as a football lover, as you and I are, £75 million for a defender, in the context of Watford General Hospital could do with £75 million, then clearly it's not only outrageous, it's obscene. But football generates that money. You know, football isn't. Of course, it's a business, but it's an entertainment business. And it, you know, if we looked at the budget for a Hollywood movie,
absolutely.
Or if we looked at the amount
Tom Cruise,
of money that a
Tom
major,
Cruise, what?
Major band earned during a worldwide tour,
yep.
that's or a boxer earns for one fight. That's the money we're talking about. My problem with football when it spends that money is if it hasn't got it.
Mm-hmm.
When clubs. Mm. And listen, Watford were in trouble 10, 12 years ago. That's an issue. But when clubs are generating the amount of money that they are, through TV, through sponsorship, through all of the other elements, through people who still come through the turnstiles, that does still happen, then I think the people who should get it are not the owners. They are the players. They are the entertainers. These are the people that make football special. These are the people that get us talking, that get us on the edge of our seats, that get us purring. And, you know, if that's the going rate for Phil Coutinho, on you go, mate.
Yeah, here. I can only second that motion. You mentioned Watford there, and obviously they march on in the FA Cup today. Congratulations to them. Clive, again, talking Premiership, I have this kind of constant bugbear that I kind of bang a drum on almost every week. I respect Watford so much. You know, 2 years ago, FA Cup semi-finalists, march in the FA Cup again, consistent Premiership team. But for me, I'm not necessarily 100% sold on their managerial merry-go-round style of organising, but that's a long chat. But I feel as though, just talking to fans in and around the areas as I do, that they have a slightly warped sense of expectation. I feel as though they really should be quite, I don't know, contented at least with where they are, what they have accomplished. It always seems that for some reason that I can't fathom, they're never quite happy, are Watford fans.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I learnt as a TV commentator is that the 99% of the people that I'm talking to are barking mad. they're not barking mad, but they are during the course of the game.
Yeah.
Because our commitment to our football team is second only to than that to our children. And standing on a touchline watching my son play football was the greatest pleasure of my life, but I was harder on him than I was on any football I've ever commentated on. It's just, if anybody else tried to criticise him, I would fight them. But, but that's the nature of our hugely emotional involvement with football, and that's why you and I are in a job, and we should be grateful for that absolute barking madness that football brings upon us. So, from time to time, we do need somebody to look at it from outside of the box that we're banging our head against. And if you look at the history of Watford Football Club, and Chris Stark's a mate of mine, so I'm fed up of hearing about Watford. I get Watford all day long. So if you look at Watford Football Club in the last 20 years, they're a championship side. That's what they are. They're
absolutely
an overachieving, right at the moment, in the Premier League, where they are in the Premier League, that most of the years of the last two decades they've spent in the Championship. If you look at the club's turnover, you look at the club's average attendance, it is absolutely a wonderful achievement that they're in the Premier League. Now, the mistake that Marco made, was to start this season very, very well.
Yes.
to then arouse interest from arguably a bigger club, or clubs certainly with a bigger tradition and bigger average attendance, which I think was maybe a little unsettling. for him and for everybody else around the club. And then to find yourself in, you know, the league within the Premier League. And how many points separate 18th from, I don't know, 8th at the moment? And Watford are in that league. And they've been performing very, 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 very well in that league until the last 5 or 6 weeks. And they've lost games to teams below them. And that's not a healthy thing to do in the Premier League. Look at the performance of Chelsea. They lost to Chelsea, but played really well. Is that right?
But they got too late. They've been, like you say, performing well over and beyond their weight.
4-1 and all that's what starts the alarm bells ringing. And now they find themselves having to look over their shoulders, which they weren't doing a month ago. But I suspect that if you'd flown every Watford fan to the moon and brought them back today, mm-hmm. and said, look where they are in the league, it's not going to be easy, but actually we're halfway at the moment. I think that is, you know, all things, given the managerial changes, which are crazy considering the success that the club has had in the last, how many, is that four managers in 4 years?
It is indeed. That's their managerial merry-go-round. It's crazy.
And ownership that has been, I think, good for the club, but an ownership which is difficult to relate to because it's so removed and so such a different model from virtually any mm-hmm. other football club in the country. You walk down past those allotments to the same ground that you walked down 20 years ago with, just as you say, a completely different set of expectations and perceptions about what you're going to see, and it must be very, very difficult at times to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. But Watford are doing fine.
They are more than fine. And I tell you my perspective coming at this, as I say, as a sleeping giant Leeds fan, and I just think to myself, oh, come on, guys, you know, I'd rather be where you are. But I tell you what, Clive, just again, conscious of your precious time, and it is much appreciated, is that you are in a position where so many would love to be. You're amongst a category of people who have lived their dream. But it hasn't always been easy. I seem to recall a show where you had to go into people's houses, I don't know, keyhole looking or something along those lines, and you had on your your office rejection letters from the BBC. Tell me a little bit about your journey, Clive, and how you got to be ITV's main man at the World Cup year.
what time do you go off air tonight? you're absolutely right. I'm told from the age of, I don't know, 12, 13, that I wanted to be a football commentator. I was never going to be a football player of any repute, so the next best thing, I guess, is to be a manager or a coach or in my case a commentator. And I was offered a job at a local radio station in Nottingham about three weeks before I took my finals at university there. It was a T-boys job, but I leapt at it. Mm-hmm. It was, just to have any involvement with broadcasting was a dream come true. And I had good breaks at good times. I think the first breaks are always the important ones. I started covering Nottingham Forest home and away for the radio station, Radio Trent, in the mid-70s. Brian Clough was the manager when I started following them. They were in the equivalent of the Championship now. They were promoted my second season in involvement. I got a move to Liverpool then to a radio station there in 77. And, you know, that was the year that Liverpool first won the European Cup. And then the next 10, 12 years, they were arguably the greatest club side that England's ever produced. And there were times during that decade when the second best side and maybe the best side were Everton. So I have had really, really good breaks in terms of working with people like Brian Clough and Bill Shankly in my early days, working with successful football teams, therefore getting some national exposure through that.
But what I would say to you is this: I'm a passionate believer that whilst you respect and are honoured and humble enough to recognise that, you make your own luck, don't you, Clive? You must have an appreciation into that.
Yeah, I think you need breaks. I think, and I think you need to be good enough and smart enough to make the most of the opportunities when they come. But I never lose sight of the fact that in all walks of life, some people don't get the opportunities. And without getting too deeply involved in my background. I'm sort of grammar school educated, mm-hmm. and from a middle class mm-hmm. background. I was able to go to university, it would have been a much more difficult journey, if I'd been brought up, well, like in Delhi, maybe, mm-hmm. on a Milton Keynes estate. I mean, you get certain advantages in life which you've got to try and. Make the most of, and I certainly never lost sight of the fact that I've had a lot of luck along the way. But I think all you can do when you get a little bit of fortune is repay it by being professional and hardworking and hopefully honest.
Yes.
Recognizing and trying to help anybody else who's trying to follow the same path.
Clive, you know what, honestly, I wish we had more time, but I'm awesomely grateful for yours. Bottom line is this, though. One thing that I think you do is that you make what you do sound really easy. And I've done it, I'm more of a rugby background, and commentating on football, I've found a different staccato, a different pace. But like I say, you make it sound like anybody could do it, and you can't simply do it as easy as all that. I want to quickly talk about that iconic moment. What went through your head when you just uttered the immortal line, "Remember the name, who can forget it?" Wayne Rooney.
Oh, I got very lucky there. I'd been working in local radio on Merseyside for a decade, really, in the build-up to getting my opportunity in television. I had good contacts at Everton. I had been to a testimonial function for an Everton player. It might have been Graham Sharp. And somebody just came up to me at the end of the dinner and told me about this kid, who I had heard about. I mean, Wayne was already pulling up trees at Youth Cup level.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this guy, I don't even know his name, who said to me, "Tell you this guy Wayne Rooney," said, "remember the name." And so as I was commentating on the game, that's what came back to me. I have to say that I did bump into the same guy on two or three other occasions, and he pulled me at the end of various functions and told me about three other players who never made it.
So it goes to show.
He once told me that Wayne's brother was twice as good as he was.
I've heard that at Whisper as well, actually, over the years. You know what, Clive? Just on Wayne Rooney, really quickly. For me, and I know this is a long conversation, I've got this question and then one more.
Don't worry.
Basically, he has been Manchester United's all-time top goal scorer. He remains England's all-time top scorer. But maybe because of the early flash where he looked like he could be, a Pelé-esque, there's this sense, I feel, that he doesn't get the dues that his body of work deserves. I'd love to get your take on that.
I think if you ask the average football fan in the middle of Watford today how old Wayne Rooney is, I think a lot of them would think he was 34 or 35. He has been around for a long time, and I think that has taken a toll on him. He's played an awful lot of football. He's played the same amount of football as most most professionals have at the age of 34 or 35. I think the achievements that you've just listed, I think great is overused in football, but I think they entitle him certainly to be considered, in going ahead as we look back on his career, as a great player. I think he's a kind of an old-fashioned player. I think the way that he plays, that there is still almost a schoolboy love for the game in the way that he goes about it, a schoolboy passion for the game. There's almost still an innocence in his game. He is naturally gifted. And I think he plays almost like a player might have done in the 70s and 80s. I think if he's absolutely honest with himself, he may well have lived his life like a player did in the 70s and 80s. But I think that's Wayne's way. And,
yep.
I don't think he'd have any regrets. I don't. If you look at the way that Ryan Giggs reinvented his career in his early 30s by, you know, finding a new a diet and by finding new fitness regimes, by, you know, discovering yoga and being open to every single possible thing that sports science could offer him in order to become 1% better, that's the requirement of the modern professional. I hope it doesn't seem a criticism of Wayne. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that he's prepared to go that extra yard, just ever wanted to. I think he was a naturally talented young footballer who has had an excellent, if not great, career doing it the way that he does it. And I think that he's probably happy with that. And if, as we know, because we've seen the pictures, he's had the odd fag along the line, along the way, and the odd the cheeseburger, then I think that's just part of the way that Wayne Rooney wanted to live his career, you know?
Absolutely. And but for me, and again, I've got literally one final question before point. The thing is, whilst all that being said, I almost feel as though he potentially suffered from that initial burst and then the media salvo behind building into this mega, mega thing. Then I also feel as though he didn't suffer necessarily, but one of the elements of his charm and his style, as you said, is his work ethic on the pitch.
Yeah.
Which meant that, you know, he wasn't necessarily in the positions where he might have actually added infinitely more to his goal tally. But that's, like I say, my mere two pennies.
I think Troy's a bit of an old-fashioned footballer. I mean, I'm not suggesting for one moment that Troy isn't an excellent professional. I think it's very important, certainly for fans of a particular generation. You know, Watford are a classic example. If you ask the average Manchester United or Chelsea fan to name the usual Watford 11, they'd struggle to get past four or five, honestly.
Yeah.
They really, really would. Because the team's been changed so much, it's come from so many nationalities. And, you know, you actually kind of need guys like Troy, who've been there for a while, who you think, well, Troy Deeney is one I know. You know, I know him. And I think that's an important sort of identity point for a football club, and particularly for the fans of a club. And you can't underestimate the value of somebody who's been around for a while, particularly when there's a revolving door of managers and players coming in, just to try to let them know who Graham Taylor was, who Luther Blissett was, what happened in 1984, what this football club is about, what it stands for, because they are really, really important things to the fans. So they've got to somehow become important to the players. And Virgil van Dijk learned more about what football means on Merseyside in one wonderful second in front of the Kop last night.
Yep.
Than hours in the company of Jamie Carragher or Stevie Gerrard could ever have taught him.
Just so eloquently broken down. One thing that, of course, all fans will be enthusing about, getting excited about, will be World Cup. Final quick question to you, Clive, before we let you go on this Saturday afternoon in the first early goings of 2018. World Cup year. Can England lift aloft the trophy?
We're in good hands. We've got good players. I think we had good players at the European Championships. I really believe that. And the Iceland match is one of the most remarkable football matches that I've ever witnessed, because they were good players on the field. And not necessarily great players, quite a lot of young players. And just something happened to them that fateful afternoon, which I know. Listen, Roy Hodgson, Ray Lewington, Gary Neville are really, really good football people. England couldn't have been in better hands in that case either. But something happened which we haven't quite explained. Gareth's a bright guy. He's trying to get to the bottom of that. He's trying to look beyond qualification, beyond even getting hopefully out of the group phase, to when hopefully we are playing knockout matches against serious teams.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get inside those players' heads and prepare them, because clearly, in some way, it's different playing for England than it is playing for Manchester United or Liverpool or Tottenham or Chelsea or Manchester. There is something that is different about it, which we've got to try to cut through, because I refuse to believe that this last 20 years that we've gone through is down to the pure ability of the players, because a lot of these players have excelled on the very best stages, on Champions League stages and so on. So it is a bit of a puzzle, and it is still, a bit of a mystery. And the only way we can solve that mystery is by dispelling the myths and by beating a couple of decent sides at a tournament and progressing in the competition. So, you know, hopefully this will be the year. It's an exciting year for us and for me, for the guys who work at the Beeb and ITV, because we've got this to ourselves. You know, the World Cup isn't on Sky, it isn't on BT Sport. It's there on free-to-air television. And if it gets a little bit of momentum, the kick-off times are pretty good in terms of everybody's daily lives. You know, they're, I think, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock, something like that. So the big games will get big audiences, and if England start to produce some big performances, we'll see the St George's flags hanging from every tenement block in Bedfordshire.
Absolutely, we can only hope at the moment. But Clive, you paint a wonderful picture. It's been for me a true honour to spend a little bit of time in your company. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday afternoon. Have all the best for what we all hope will be a very successful 2018. Thank you once again.
Thank you for having me on. Cheers now. Goodbye.